You all here. Carly, can you please read the title to report that is noted on item number 117?
Accept report on the Native American community in Multnomah County, an unsettling report.
Would folks please like to come forward? I'm very pleased to submit this report for City Council consideration, and in doing so, seek to honor the fantastic Native American community that Portland and the Portland area are very blessed to have, and also to establish or to create a marker of where we're at, what we've accomplished, and most importantly, where we need to go. So it's with that that I'm very pleased to introduce Nicole Maher. Oh, I'm sorry.
All right.
Please, a distinguished panel of guests, and welcome. Glad that you're here.
Well, good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Sherry Addis, and I manage the Portland Area Office of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians. And I want to thank you for setting aside time for us today to talk about this important report. We're here formally to present to you the Native American community in Multnomah County, an unsettling profile. This is an in-depth report, and the slides, are they showing to anyone? Okay. This is an in-depth report encompassing the data from 27 systems and institutions with side-by-side comparisons of our situation as a people. And it examines the disparities that exist for the Native community. This report is a result of a partnership with PSU Community School of Social Work, the Coalition of Community of Color, and the Native community. And we wish to further acknowledge our funders, which include the City of Portland, and say thank you. You may ask, who are the Native community that participated in this report? And so I invite you to take a look around the room today. And if I might ask for all Native Americans who are here today to support this report, if you could just stand momentarily. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. You'll see, you saw there a small sampling of the ninth largest urban Indian population in the United States. We today represent not only just the people who live here, but also such organizations as the Portland Indian Leaders Roundtable, which includes 28 Native American organizations. We included Native elders who have provided wisdom and guidance and feedback for this report. And I'm proud to say that despite generations of trauma, we have survived and continue to be a vibrant, diverse, and culturally centered people. For some well-intentioned people, even good-hearted people, the information in this report may come as a shock. They may doubt or seek to parse or explain away some of the data they see. And we ask you today as a community not to shy away from this information. We understand that it can reveal some hard truths that some may not want to acknowledge, that there are huge disparities between the needs of the Native community and the services that are provided in Portland, Oregon. In addition, when the data is compared to Seattle's King County or the U.S. averages, the disparities worsen. We feel this report can serve as a foundation, though, to identify strategies for addressing the disparities and improving the lives of the Native American community members. And we also understand that we all need to work together to find solutions. The city, the Native community, we all need to work together to seek those solutions. And we assure you that we are willing to work to do that hard work. So, how many Native Americans call Multnomah County home? The community verified population count of Native Americans in Multnomah County is 40,783. Other counts vary, as is shown on this slide. causing us to have deep concerns of undercounts, which further disenfranchise our people. The next graph shows a breakdown of population by age distribution. It's interesting to note that 63% of our population are under the age of 35. At this time, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Dr. Ann Curry Stevens to go further into the data.
Thank you, Sherry. I'm pleased to be sharing this information with you today. I'd like to first begin by acknowledging what tend to be the explanations we turn to when we consider the issue of disparities. We sometimes turn to language issues, longevity and length of time in the region, recognition of foreign credentials, poverty issues. What we see here is that none of those are explanation factors for why the community is in such distress. What we see here, and what is a very tough turn for most of us to make, is a turn towards the nature of institutional racism and the nature specifically of longstanding institutions which end up with preferential treatment and preferential experiences for white members of our communities. And so we end up with an unsettling set of data, but one that is essential for making progress forwards. And so we'll see here as I move through a number of these slides the scope and the magnitude of disparities. We're looking at poverty rates locally that are generally at least three times deeper and worse. At the far right end of this chart, we have a poverty rate of 80% for single moms raising kids under five in the Native community today. We often would like to believe that the distress facing the Native community is a function of a bad economy. And what this slide shows us is actually that's not sufficient to explain what's happening. When we look at the gray bars on the first three columns, that is the situation facing whites across the U.S., first at the U.S. level, then at Multnomah County, or at Oregon level, and then at Multnomah County. When we compare that to the teal bars, the three bars on the right, we see poverty levels that are escalating the closer we get to Multnomah County. There is a locally troubling scenario that is pronounced and profound and resulting in the child poverty level, child poverty data, one in two Native children living in poverty today. Yearly incomes are approximately half. What we've added this time from the time we were here before sharing these data with you is the full-time year-round median income. That is close to one-half the size. So comparing workers who are working full-time year-round, income levels are close to half. Those that are making below the median income, this is a 20-year time span. What we have is a constant level, fairly constant level for white households and a rapidly deteriorating poverty situation and low-income situation facing Native Americans. That long-term rate is particularly troubling. We don't have a dynamic where, left alone, things are getting better. The reverse is true. This next slide lets us take a look at how our communities are doing compared to their national comparators. And you've heard this story before, that the local data is worse. What is particularly troubling and to some degree adding insult to injury is that white incomes have a perk, have a bump up, a benefit in being here compared to national comparators, when completely the inverse is true at the Native community, for the Native community. In occupations, our best jobs are on the left in terms of management and professional jobs. Here, Native communities are deeply, deeply underrepresented and overrepresented in our worst jobs. Unemployment level, this is far from current data. There's an issue around access to data, but we are typically seeing unemployment levels in the Native community that are typically double that of whites. In housing, those that are housing burdened, spending more than 30% of their incomes on housing, both as renters and as owners, a deeply troubling profile. This is data comparing those at similar income levels in home ownership rates, but I draw your attention to the data on the right, which says how many people are turned away from loan application practices. And we're looking at approximately double, regardless of your income. The rate of being denied loans is doubly worse here today for the Native community. We now turn to some of our institutional practices, some of the public services in Multnomah County. The last one was in the private market in terms of loan denial rates. So in public housing, we have the worst data is that 3.2% of public housing residents are Native, whereas an appropriate target would be 6.8% of the community. So we're very underrepresented there. And the same picture, though a little bit better, is the targets in terms of those receiving tenant support vouchers.
And how do you define public housing on that chart?
This is data taken from the
Bureau of Housing as well as the Housing Authority. It's a combined portfolio. So basically what it shows is essentially how many Native folks are accessing those services versus how many Native folks are eligible and should be, just based on how we're purely represented in the population per poverty. I will note that the 3.2% is a significant increase. Four years ago, we were looking at as little as 1%, so we are making progress.
Nicole, are we under public housing, are we aggregating Home Forward plus subsidized housing that's not operated by Home Forward?
Yes.
You're using public housing in a very,
yes,
in a very broad way.
Yes. Homelessness numbers, the Native community is deeply overrepresented and growing. Educational attainment, we're looking at 1 in 3 Native community members not having graduated high school, whereas that number is 1 in 17 for whites. And at the high end, deeply underrepresented again in higher education. Head Start, where a pathway to education and to educational success begins. Today, for the age group of being under 5, 15% of those under 5 in poverty are Native. That it would be the appropriate target that we'd like to see in terms of access to Head Start programming. The Native community is 4.4% in Portland Public Schools region of access to those Head Start numbers. Cohort graduation rates, this has not been updated with the recent release last week of these data. We are looking at today, so this is, we looked first at the historic pattern around access to education and success in graduating public school. We're looking at today's rates where more than 1 in 2 Native community members are not graduating high school on time today. The variation across school boards was important to share with you to show that we're looking at essentially an 80% failure rate in graduating on time in some of our school districts.
Have you drilled down into some of these, for instance, noticing that Centennial seems to be doing well? Do we have some suggestions on what's working?
Yeah, we have a very deep partnership with Centennial where we identify students in 6th and 7th grade and partner with them to provide wraparound tutoring, culturally appropriate services. So we have a very deep partnership with Centennial, and we also have had a great relationship with some of the other districts that have a little bit higher graduation rate. We actually have a higher graduation rate for Native children than any other ethnic group in Centennial. And then you can clearly see some of the districts that we have had less of a partnership with.
So we've seen what we've tried and it's worked, so we can then replicate it.
We absolutely know how to see Native children succeed and graduate in very high numbers, and we have lots of examples of serving very high-risk Native populations and seeing them be incredibly successful.
And your own Native American school, the graduation rate last year?
We've had 2 consecutive years of an 88% graduation rate and expect to see a higher graduation rate this year.
Thank you.
Professor, how do you account for student mobility for tracking when you track graduation rates? Because what we see in substandard housing or entry-level housing. It's just a lot of movement, and we also see kids coming in and out of school districts depending on where they're displaced because of poverty. So how does your data account for that?
We've used the Department of Education's data on that, and it includes, we don't fail to recognize students in the cohort graduation rate if they've changed school districts. And so they've got a tracking system that I don't know the details of, but they have not penalized the school districts for having had students move out to or into their districts.
The one thing that this chart does not recognize, and this will be important when you hear reports from the Latino, the Slavic, and African-American community, is that we actually have a fairly significant dropout rate between 7th and 8th grade, and again between 8th and 9th grade. And so these charts actually only represent the young people who get to their freshman year. And in this community, we have a lot of out-of-school youth who just never make it to that benchmark. So that is a deficiency with the data. And we know when we look at just pure census numbers of how many young people are in the age group, it doesn't true up with the number of kids that are identified as Native in our school districts.
We turn now to health insurance and health care coverage. There's a narrow, this data is only available at the Oregon-wide level. We have a much better performance in 2000, and the rate has deteriorates very rapidly and significantly to 2006, and then is narrowing again by 2009. Our best understanding is that's a function of the Healthy Kids expanded access for our children. We're still looking at the uninsured levels of the Native community being twice as high as that of the white community.
Do we know what happened between 2000 and 2006?
Don't know. Enrollment in Healthy Kids. While the numbers are significant in terms of their being improved from year to year, we're still looking at a deep underrepresentation. We should have a target of 8.4% of numbers in Healthy Kids being Native American children, whereas that number is about four times too low. The juvenile justice system, we have some improvements on several of these measures from 2008 to 2009. Most troubling, however, is in the numbers charged and the numbers brought to detention, pointing to some fairly troubling early steps in the justice system. And in a moment, you'll see a bit more data on the police charging rates. Child welfare, this is a number with which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is the idea that the closer one gets to Multnomah County across the nation, the more likely we are to pull kids out of their homes and place them in foster care. We also see an astronomically higher level of Native children in care at 20.1% of Native American children are in care in the year of the study. There has been some improvement in that time, but the numbers are still deeply overrepresented. Here's a comparison at the national rate. So we see essentially that the Native community is three times higher than that of whites at the nationwide level. We're looking at a rate that is on an exponentially worse situation locally. Here's the data on the police charges, and we see a positive trend with the police charging rates dropping very quickly and very significantly for whites, but the alternative pattern is so for the Native American community. We turn back to child welfare again here and do a comparison with King County, where King County is taking vastly reduced numbers of Native children out of their homes compared to child welfare situations here. So we aspire to a target that is at the same level of King County's apprehension, taking white children out of their homes. We have a long way to go.
What do you attribute to the difference?
Well, I think that Oregon has a long legacy of racial disparities, pertaining to removing children of color and putting them into foster care. And so that long legacy impacts us today. In addition to that, we know that because so many children were removed historically and put into foster care, and we know that children who grew up in foster care are more likely to have their children removed. The other reality, and it's very uncomfortable to talk about, but the really positive thing that DHS has done is done some really good work at decision point analysis. And what they've discovered is that every point where an adult has a decision to make, and when you look at their decisions that they make regarding Native Americans and African Americans versus white families, it's very, very different. And so there is some very real evidence that we have deep racial disparities.
And that's more so than King County.
Oh, I apologize. King County has actually done a very intentional effort to partner with the community and to really engage the community in including solutions. And they started much longer ago than we have. If you would have talked to them 10 and 15 years ago, they were in a similar situation with deep disparities. And so I think they've been very intentional. They've also made some very intentional investments at the state and the local level. The one thing I would say is that in our more recent investment with the Children's Levy focusing on Native Americans, we essentially took the entire King County model and brought it to this community in addition to a model from Denver and Minneapolis. And I think, there's been some good strides recently, but I do think that the Children's Levy investment around foster care is actually a big piece of, the reason we should celebrate that the numbers are getting better.
As a social work professor, we're working at our end, but again, in a timeline that is much slower than King County's, to help our students understand the impact of their whiteness, of their white bias and preferences and stereotypes in working with communities of color, and how that then infuses their practice and their decision-making on a day-to-day basis.
I just have to ask, are children... So I was in the legislature a long time, dealt with a lot of DHS issues, was on a committee that oversaw kids that were taken. So I'm compelled to ask, are you arguing that children are being taken from family situations that aren't dangerous, that should be left with the parents? Or are you arguing that they should be left in situations that are equally as dangerous as what white kids are left in?
So I'll answer that. There's actually overwhelming data that shows that Native Americans do not abuse their children at any higher rates than the white population.
That doesn't make me feel better.
Right.
It
shouldn't.
What doesn't make me feel better that they don't abuse them any higher than? Right. My question is more, are you arguing that children are removed from Native American homes for the same level of abuse that...
They are left in the home
of white children.
Yeah, so in the decision point analysis, essentially what they looked at is multiple cases where almost the exact same report was made, the exact same incident, very similar incidents, and essentially if the child was white, the family was white, they were much more likely to be referred to social services, be given support, get parent support, parent education classes, whereas if they were a Native or an African American family, they were much more likely to be removed from the system or from the home and put into the system, and then once in the system, much more likely to receive services and support and much less likely to be returned home, which is very serious. The other thing that's important to note about Native American families is that we are much more likely to be removed for issues like poverty-related neglect. So if the families are homeless, if they're not able to have stable housing, different issues like that. I think, as a community, we absolutely want our children to be safe and nurtured. And if there is abuse and neglect, of course we want any protective mechanisms to take place. But we also know that there are really effective strategies that can keep families safe and together. And we want equal access to those services in a culturally responsive way.
Recent data has come out on a study of the giving patterns of public and private foundations. And here in this data, we see that even when needs are pronounced, that communities are eligible for grants, that the Native community is receiving far less than a sense of fair share of funding dollars in the philanthropic sector. These are funds that are publicly subsidized because of the establishment of foundations, and they become an important arena around public accountability for foundation funding practices. We also are close to wrapping the data profile. This is some of the specific comparisons with King County: child poverty, rent burden, incomes, occupation, university degrees, and we're looking at levels that are approximately half, getting close to half as worse, half as bad, or 40% worse locally than they are in King County. And this is a tough piece to look at, but I just ask that you pay attention to the sea of red. We're looking at, this is changes over the last 3 years, what has happened to a wide array of measures we've been able to look at. This project's been underway for 4 years. We have the data for a three-year period. We're looking at a sea of downturns, of patterns where dynamics are worse. The final comment I'd like to make is that time and again, we see the Native community with more pronounced needs and less access to support and remedial kinds of interventions. That it is, Native Americans are much less likely to get services they need despite the evidence that they have more pronounced need for them.
Professor, can I just add, your data is Multnomah County and
yes.
Then comparative. So I had two questions off of that. What percentage of the population that you're tracking in Multnomah County lives in Portland?
Two-thirds to three-quarters.
And this is probably beyond the scope of your research, but I'd be interested just in your sense. If you just looked Portland, the Portland component of Multnomah County, would you expect to see any variations in the data in any of the categories?
I'd need to think about that in terms of the scope of the reach of what we've looked at. The education data out of Portland Public Schools is not better than other school districts. That's one of the places where we've looked at disaggregated data to a high degree. And I would hazard a guess that there's not a lot of difference.
So you'd expect to extrapolate with the Portland component of the overall Native population would be roughly the same outcomes and disparities that you've documented for countywide.
It would be hard to imagine that there's a protective factor going on here that would make disparities better. It's hard to imagine that, knowing what we know of the systems, of the institutional racism that exists across systems, over the preferential situation that whites are experiencing in the majority of our systems. Thank you.
Welcome. Glad you're here.
Let us put our minds together and see what life we can make for our children. That's one of the more notable quotes of that great Sioux warrior, Chief Sitting Bull. Good afternoon, Koyana. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. My name is Frank Albee. I am president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Columbia River Camp 49 here in Portland. I am also an elder at the Native American Youth and Family Center. Camp 49 is probably the newest Native organization in Portland, and it is our desire to be a part of the many local Native organizations that are advocating for policy decisions that will improve the outcomes of Portland's Native American community. Now, why an Alaska Native organization in Portland so far away? There are many Alaska Natives that live here in Portland. In fact, we're second to Seattle as far as Alaska Native. Did you know that Seattle is known as the largest Alaska Native village in the United States? That's because Seattle has more Alaska Natives living in Seattle than there are in any Native village in Alaska. Maybe it's the warmer climate, I don't know. But we do have a lot of, and Portland is right behind them. Portland has a lot of Alaska Natives, and we're living down here for a myriad of reasons, you know. And we want to be a part of the Native community, not only of Portland, you know, but of Oregon. We want to be good neighbors. In reviewing the study and unsettling profile, it's very obvious that there is much work to be done by all sides. Some of the disparities shown in the report are deteriorating even now. We're fortunate to have Native leaders like Nicole Mayer, who's the executive director of Native American Youth and Family Center, Sherry Adits, who works for the Siletz Tribe, Terry Cross, National Indian Child Welfare Association, and so many others that are working tirelessly in our people's behalf. But we need your help. We want to partner, you know, with the city of Portland and Multnomah County and the state of Oregon, you know, to help us overcome these deficiencies that need to be, you know, taken care of. Anytime you go into a big fight, you're looking for some big guy to help you, to be on your side. And so I think sitting here looking at you, we're looking at him now, you know. We're looking at the people that can help us. And so we're asking you, you know, to help us approach these problems. Because working together, you know, we can become stronger, all of us. I want to thank you for inviting us to City Hall. I actually feel, I've never been in this building before, but I feel pretty good. In my previous life, I was a city manager. I've served on the city council and the school board in our village in Alaska. I'm also retired from the U.S. Army and the United States Civil Service. Today, my wife and I are enjoying our retirement in the beautiful City of Roses. All of us together, you know, we share the same sunshine. We share the rain. We share the wind. And so it's good to be here, you know, sharing with you today, you know, what our needs are, and in hoping that you'll partner with us, you know, to help us. And we will help you any way we can. Thank you very much. Koyana, koyanakpak.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to talk about some of the recommendations we have collectively created as a community. It's my honor to be here again. My name is Nicole Maher. I'm a member of the Tlingit Tribe. I am a card-carrying member of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. And very proud of it. So the first thing I'd like to really say is that I think as a community we recognize that this data is very overwhelming, and it's sad to think that we're one of the cities in this great country that has one of the largest and poorest Native populations. But this report is really important and a real celebration to our community, because for so long we have been trying to make our case and maybe having, you know, an individual conversation about education or foster care, and starting so many meetings, first by trying to convince folks that we're a large, important community here, and then second, trying to talk about the disparities. And what is so powerful for our community and what makes us so optimistic is that we can stop having that debate. When you look at 27 indicators using mainstream data, and there is such an overwhelming need, it's really a message to all of you and all of the bureaus that you supervise and our entire community that it's time to start working towards solutions. And I actually think that there's a lot to celebrate at the city. When I look back at the last couple of years, we've actually made, and I say this as a member of the city and of the community, we've made a lot of really great progress. This report shows us that we have so far to go, but I think that with the recent approval, I believe it was last week, where we approved the first policy in the United States to remedy some of the undercounts in the census, I think that is very powerful. And I think we as a community will benefit greatly from the policies that will happen as a result of that policy. We're watching very closely the creation of the Office of Equity, and we're very excited to see the results and feel very committed and share in the importance of the success of that effort. And I think that is a really great stride. We're appreciative of all of the work from the Children's Levy to focus on issues of foster care. We're very appreciative of some of the work that Randy championed around engaging all communities of color in fair and equitable contracting. I think I mentioned this earlier, but in the area of housing, even though we have a long way to go, I think that bureau in particular is particularly impressive because of its hiring of Native American leaders, and actually we've seen some of the greatest gains in doing a better job at serving Native Americans because of some very specific policies. And I actually wanted to take a moment and appreciate you, Sam. You actually were one of the champions on City Council to fund this project for the entire coalition. And I think it's also important to note that you have been a champion for Native Americans long before the rest of the city of Portland knew that we lived here or that we were the ninth largest Native community. So I want to say that while this report is overwhelming and there are a lot of disparities, I think that we have a strong, united Native community. We have over 21 organizations represented here today. We have Tribal Councilman Chris Mercier from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde that's here. We have former Vice Chair of the Cowlitz Tribe, Christine Dupree. And I just think we have a really fantastic collection of Native leaders who are ready to join you in coming up with solutions. And I have a few suggestions here. The first is really to say that while we have great disparities, we want our community to be recognized for the opportunity that we present. When you look at how incredibly overrepresented we are in homelessness, we want that to be perceived as an opportunity. We know from things that have been done in other cities what we can do to address that issue. And if we can do that, we will actually significantly decrease the overall amount of homelessness we have in the city by focusing on our community because we're so overrepresented. We know when you look at our overall high school graduation rates, if we were able to move Native high school graduation rates to be at parity with the entire district, we would increase our overall graduation rate by 10%. Why wouldn't we want to do that? That seems like an absolutely fantastic strategy to improve outcomes for the entire city. Just to get more specific with some of our recommendations, we are very committed to the city having a long-term vision and action plan for racial equity. We are very interested in very thoughtful plans and goals over time. Sometimes in this community, and the city is not the only party guilty of this, but in Portland, we have a lot of efforts that are really focused on, well, we tried hard or we put a lot of energy into it, but you don't actually see the outcome shift. And as a community, we are very focused on outcome-driven efforts, efforts that are built on best practices that we've seen from other communities. And we are very interested in really focusing on how we are choosing to use our resources and how all members who live in the community and pay taxes benefit from those resources and services. And every service that the city offers should be thoughtful about ensuring that Native communities have equal access. That's everything to parks, community centers, services for homeless folks, every bureau. It's very important that planning and sustainability are very intentional about engaging Native communities and that planning effort. One thing that's very important is that as a community, we don't organize by geography. And so when you're looking at engaging the community through an effort around either neighborhood associations or URACs, it's important to note that we organize as an ethnic group. And while we're incredibly overrepresented and have large populations in many URACs, just organizing and engaging the community in that effort is not sufficient, and intentional strategies have to be used. We are very committed to helping and being a partner with the city to increase the number of Native Americans who are employed there and increase the number of Native Americans who are employed in high-level positions of leadership. We see that when bureaus have high-level leaders from communities of color and in particular Native American communities, the city does a better job serving our population. And when the city does a better job serving our population, we're spending our tax resources better and we're making greater gains to improving the overall livability of the city. specifically around housing. We're very interested in culturally specific decentralized services. So when we create services that are a one-size-fits-all model and, you know, sort of it's dependent on folks being the most sophisticated at navigating the system, our community experiences a lot of barriers. Whereas when we've designed the services to actually meet the needs of the population, this is not just true for Native Americans, we see much greater gains. One example is in home ownership. If you would have looked at the Native community 6 years ago, we were not participating in any of the city's home ownership efforts. We have since partnered and tailored culturally specific strategies to reach the Native community. Since then, we have celebrated over 115 new Native homeowners. Not a single one has defaulted, and we've leveraged $22 million in lending through that specific partnership with the community. And it just really shows that we don't have to spend more resources. We just have to be more thoughtful in the way that we spend those resources to make sure that everyone benefits. And it's not as though our community is asking for anything special or unique. We're just asking the city to be smart about the way they invest their resources so it's effective for all aspects of the community. Our community wants to be part of decision making. You can see today by today's attendance that we're committed. We are going to be in this community for a long time. You can see that our population is growing astronomically, actually, and we want to be part of creating that future for Portland. We want to be viewed as an asset to the community, and that means being part of decisions for RAC. We're very pleased to have a Native member on the RAC board. We're very pleased to think about ways that RAC can improve funding members of the Native community. But it's not just issues around, you know, poverty or housing. We want to be part of the city in all places. Certainly that includes parks and recreation. One specific recommendation that we have is that this city is blessed with a beautiful park system. Many of those parks are tied to culturally significant spaces. Portland is home to a very rich and vibrant history. We have 8 tribes who the city of Portland is within the geographic area where there are 8 federal treaties. And it's important that our parks honor and tell the entire history and the entire story and celebrate their connection to our original indigenous inhabitants. So at that time, I'll stop with my recommendations and open it up if any of you have any questions. But I wanted to end by appreciating and thanking all of you, because I know all of you have individually done really important work to serve our community, and we want to see that partnership and that work continue and grow, particularly now that we have such a strong sense of the urgent need.
Well, I have a question. Thank you for your work and for the recommendations. What would you say are the lessons learned? And I like the touchstone of King County, because it's not that far away and not that different than we are, although it rains a lot more up there. What would you say are the lessons learned if they had to do it over again to go faster and be more effective?
The lessons learned about doing the report, or just...
No, the lessons learned in the level of achievement at King County is inspiring mm-hmm. and daunting at the same time. Sort of, if they had to do it over again, or what they've learned along the way, what would you say are mm-hmm. a few key lessons from just seeking to make the changes?
Yeah, I think that there are some great lessons we've learned from King County, as well as some other jurisdictions. We pay a lot of attention to what they're doing in Denver and Minneapolis, because they have very similar sized populations. And one of the things that we notice in King County and some of those other communities is when government institutions started to sort of share the problem and be less defensive. So sometimes there's this desire to say, you know, we're trying really hard, we're doing this, this, and this, the problem's not as bad. And when cities kind of said, you know, we do have significant disparities, we're not going to solve it on our own, and really partnered and were willing to shift how they were providing services in a way that matched the populations, not just the Native community, but other communities, they saw significant gains. And I think the willingness of leaders to sort of admit the challenge and share the challenges, as well as invite solutions, has been very, very significant. I think the other lessons learned, you know, are really setting a very targeted approach. We recognize we're not going to decrease disparities in a year, but we should be thoughtful about saying, you know, what is the benchmark for next year, the year after? What's our five-year plan? And I think when those are co-created with communities, it can be very effective. I think sometimes it seems scary to have those conversations because communities feel frustrated and they feel like they've been knocking on the door for a long time. But when you really invite communities in, they're reasonable. They want to be helpful. We want to be part of the solution. It's not enjoyable for our community to continually, you know, advocate and discuss disparities. We would much rather get to the work of making change. And so those are two specific things I can think of that the city and certainly our county could benefit from.
Thank you. Additional discussion? How many people have signed up to testify? Okay. Next steps. Tomorrow. Kind of next steps.
Yeah. Well, I think that we have tried to put forward some recommendations. We are certainly looking at this year's budget process. We recognize the city is incurring significant cuts. However, when such great inequity exists, it's very important in this budget process to be very closely looking at the decisions that are being made and ensuring that no additional disparities will be created by any cuts that potentially could be made. I think that there are multiple opportunities for partnership. The Portland Indian Leaders Roundtable has continually offered to be a partner in improving the number of Native Americans that are hired. I think that we stand ready to help you fill your boards and commissions with very qualified, fabulous Native community members from a variety of backgrounds. If asked, we are very prepared to do that. I think we would like to be a very strong partner in ensuring that more housing is built that has the ability to serve Native Americans well. We're very, very interested in how services are offered to the homeless community. We had a great slide showing how overrepresented we are in the homeless population, and that is particularly true for young people and families, not just adults, although we do have our share of single adults. But what we also know is that in our current mix of services that serve homeless people, Native folks are very underrepresented. So if there's an opportunity to work on that issue, we would love to partner. So we have lots of ideas.
And good ones. So thank you. Thank you all very much for your testimony. Did you have something?
Are we going to vote?
We're going to vote to accept the report. Yep. All right. Thank you very much. Carla, would you please call the vote? Oh, I move to accept the report.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Carla, would you please call the vote on the motion to accept the report titled The Native American Community in Multnomah County, an Unsettling Report.
Fritz.
Thank you, everyone, for participating today. I was reminded by Chairwoman Cheryl Kennedy of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde that this is your land and you're really welcoming me to it. As an immigrant from England, I remember that and regret what my ancestors did to your ancestors, and will do my part to correct the outcomes that have been coming down for centuries. And so thank you, especially to Nicole Maha, for your partnership over the 3 years that I've been in office, making the invisible visible for me personally, teaching me what I didn't know, and creating in me this urge to make amends and to get better. As you say, we need just bringing Native children's graduation rates up to parity with everybody else would make a 10% raise in all of our graduation rates. That's significant. So we can and must make sure that everybody in our community succeeds, and in culturally specific ways. So what has worked at Centennial for Native American children may not work at a different school with a different group, and we need to recognize that it's not one size fits all. And when we try to make it one size fits all, that's when all of the disparities that the Coalition of Communities of Color has brought to light continue to worsen, and it's worse here. I don't think we're quite at the point where we can stop talking about the disparities and stop making the case. It's been saddening how many people don't understand why we're creating the Office of Equity and Human Rights, and how many people just think, well, if we just keep doing what we're doing, things will get better. We know that that is not the case. And so I invite each one of you to continue telling your stories, to continue telling people, explaining to people what the facts are. The good part is we do now know the facts, and thank you to Portland State University for making that evident. but we aren't yet at the stage where everybody understands what we're doing. And indeed, the Office of Equity and Human Rights is going to be a partnership. So I can't tell you exactly what the work plan is going to be just yet, because we're going to develop it together. And I thank those of you in the community here who've been helping the mayor and me in the creation committee and in the formation of that office. And I look forward to the ongoing partnership. To me, that's what's different about the Office of Equity compared with other efforts in the past. We recognize that none of us can do it by ourselves and that we all need to work together to correct these problems, which are problems for all of us and yet experienced so deeply and so disparately that we can't not do anything. So when people do push back on me and say, well, why are you doing this and why are you spending this money on the Office of Equity and Human Rights, after I've explained some of the objective evidence, I sometimes get to, do you have a better idea? And I have not yet heard of anybody who has been able to come back with something that would say, this is what would work and we know it. I appreciate the study that this pulls out what has worked in the Native community and what hasn't, and I'm looking forward to getting some more discussion on what we've learned from King County, what we've learned elsewhere, what we've tried and failed here. And sometimes we try something and it's the second time that you try it that it works. We can't stop trying. That's my commitment to the Native communities and to the city of Portland, that we have to keep trying. And I thank you so much for your partnership. Thank Mayor Adams for his leadership on this. I appreciated, Nicole, your pointing out that he has been working on this for many, many years as a chief of staff and as a city commissioner, as well as mayor. And I hope that our next mayor is even close to us committed to equity and is dedicated to making sure that everybody in our community has the opportunity to succeed and the support and the partnership from the city of Portland that's necessary to make that happen. Aye.
Fish.
Well, thanks to all four of you for your excellent presentation. I actually thought with the large crowd here we were going to be shifting to testimony. So I appreciate that in effect you were speaking for the larger community and then acknowledging the diverse representation that's here. Just a couple of comments. One is that I sometimes am criticized in my housing work of spending too much time dwelling on the progress we're making and not enough on the challenges we face. And I very much appreciate, Nicole, the way you slice that, because I think one of the challenges in our work, particularly when we're faced with data and problems that can be overwhelming, is that we don't create the space to celebrate what we are doing, at the same time acknowledging that we're falling short and we have to do better. It's a delicate balance. But I think what inspires people is the notion that we are making an effort, but we have to do more. And I think that's the message I got loud and clear. You were very gracious, a number of you, in identifying things that have changed at the city, very significant things. But we have so much more work to do, but we need to celebrate the little wins, but then make sure that we keep our eye on the prize. So I appreciate that. Professor, this is I forget the number, but you've been working with the coalition on a number of these studies, and I joined you the other day. The mayor and I had the pleasure of joining you in the release of the data on the Latino community. And thank you for giving us the good baseline data to make policy decisions going forward. It's absolutely essential.
Thank you.
To our other honored guests, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Albee, I was struck, sir. I am not a card-carrying member of your organization, although knowing Nicole, I will be soon. I want to thank you for joining us. And I loved your comment about we all share the sun and we all share the rain and this notion that we're all in it together. Dr. King said it slightly differently, not as eloquently as you just did, but he said, we do not walk alone. We're all in this together. And I think the message today is, and the consistent message we've had as we've looked at these disparities is, this is not a problem of the Native American community. This is not a problem necessarily of Portland or just Multnomah. This is our problem. And I think the council is taking some bold steps and ultimately will be judged on the basis of outcomes. Good intentions are not enough. But what makes me pretty confident that we're going to make progress is that I see the people who are at the table holding us accountable. In my work in housing, there's Ray Espana at our PHAC, making sure that we're trying to get it right. On my parks oversight board, there's Nicole raising challenging questions of equity and accountability at every juncture. Danielle Ledesma, the Housing Bureau, keeping me honest. The folks that are helping us shape our new work around fair housing. It's making sure, as you said, that we welcome community to the table to help us do this work, and then ultimately being accountable. So to me, there are challenges, but we're making progress. And I think the larger question is the sunshine, or point I would say is the sun shines on all of us. We all share this beautiful place. Now let's all work together to make it a better place. So thank you for your work. Mayor Adams, thank you for your leadership. Commissioner Fritz, thank you for your willingness to take on the Office of Equity, which I think will be a substantial change in our work here. Aye.
Saltzman.
I want to thank Mr. Albee, Ms. Addis, Professor, and I have a hunch Julia Meyer had a lot to do with your reports too, so I want to acknowledge her. Chris, I want to acknowledge you, and most of all, I want to acknowledge Nicole, because when I think about, you know, what's different in this Portland environment in the last, I don't know, 6-10 years, you know, the only thing I can really think of is Nicole Maher being on the scene and really giving life and breadth to the Native American community, the Native American Youth Association, you know, pulling off significant accomplishments like having your own high school. If there's a board or commission that Nicole doesn't serve on, I can't name it or hasn't served on. And I know just recently I represent the city on the Travel Portland Board of Directors, and we had just had a meeting last week, and Nicole went down to Albuquerque with a delegation from Travel Portland and was successful in getting a Native association, I forget which one. Historically, they meet in Albuquerque for their convention, but they're coming to Portland in a couple of years. And so I just really want to acknowledge, you know, if there's anything I can think of that's really different on the scene, I think it's you. And so I don't mean to take away from everybody else who's working hard on these issues, but she has given visibility, life, and focus, I think, to these issues. So just want to acknowledge you. And so thank you very much for this report. And it is a report we will work to remedy and make better. Aye.
Leonard?
So I read the report, and it is jarring. And I hope you'll forgive me that I focused on one particular section on page 67, where there is a significant, if not brief, discussion about recovery in the Native American community. And then you use as the example the Native American Rehabilitation Association in Northwest Portland that I happen to know is on St. Helens Road near Scappoose. In late 2008, 2009, my daughter lived there for 6 months. And I went there every Sunday and spent the afternoon with my grandson for each of those 6 months. And we have, he and I both have really good memories, not just of being there with Kara, but of talking to the counselors that were Native American and participating in a number of different ceremonies over that time. One which I've told often this story was a ceremony that involved a number of different Native American traditions, but included a sweat lodge. And my daughter was very insistent that I participate in the sweat lodge because I've always been a fan of saunas, and she thought I could stick it out with the elders. And upon entering the sweat lodge, there was a little meeting of all of us that were entering for the ceremony, which included Native drums and chanting in the sweat lodge. But the elder looked at the whole crowd, I being the only white person in the crowd, and said, "There are 3 levels of the sweat lodge, and you're welcome to leave at any level. The last level is known as the white buffalo level." And he looked right at me and said, "It's probably a good idea, if you haven't done this before, to leave at the white buffalo level." Well, of course, I decided that I would, they would pull me out before I left the white buffalo level. So I stayed as others left. There ended up being about 3 of us left two elders and myself that made it. And from that point on, I felt a different relationship with the folks at NARA. They accepted me because I made it through the White Buffalo Round. And as a result, I've always felt I've been very supportive of Native American issues, but felt like I've had a much deeper spiritual connection, if you will, with the Native American community since then, and have been, of course, very grateful for all the work that they do, and not just amongst Native Americans, but obviously for people that are not Native American, which I was very humbled by and appreciate. So if there's anything in my remaining time here I can do to help, I certainly hope you ask, because I will gratefully do it. Aye.
Adams.